We have the opportunity this quarter, at this time, to return to our study of the Gospel of John. I think there's no better part of Scriptures that we can study than those that talk directly about our Savior, because everything else revolves around that. Everything from the Old Testament was pointing to Him, and the things we read in the Gospels, and everything after the Gospels in our New Testament happen because of Him and depend on Him and look back at Him and what we read in those Gospels. When we taught this last year, we covered the first 11 chapters of the Gospel of John, but really the word cover is an unfair word. We briefly scanned the first 11 chapters, because there's so much more than that there. And that will be the case again. As we look at 12 through 21 of the Gospel of John, we're only going to be able to sort of pull out the overarching picture and specific things out of that, but there's so much more that's available. But I would like to tell you that we did take the handouts from last year and reworked them and put them together into a study guide or booklet that's available in the bookstore. If you'd like to pick that up across the street during our hours when we're open, and I think it will be beneficial to you. We intend to do the same thing with this set of handouts we're producing now for this study as well. You know, we have an interesting set of expressions in our language and culture. It goes something like this: familiarity breeds contempt. But that's not always the case. So there are some other expressions that are somewhat similar that work the same way. And one of them is familiarity produces complacency. Well, maybe that isn't one. Maybe I just made that up. But that's one of the things we struggle in our relationships with each other, for example, and no place greater than in our relationship with our spouse, if we're married, and with our children, if we have them. Sometimes we start taking those relationships for granted. The same is true with the Scriptures, and perhaps because we feel like we've heard so many stories from Jesus and about Jesus and heard so much out of the Gospels concerning Him, I don't think we take them necessarily as seriously as they were intended to be taken. Think about what was happening at the time these books were written: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Jesus has returned to heaven. The men and women that He leaves behind as His eyewitnesses to what He had done and what He had said and who He was are now charged with the responsibility of taking the gospel to the whole world. They go to work, but there's only so many people you can talk to personally or even in a crowd and communicate the story about Jesus. Besides which, it's not very long before they start dying. Many of them because of persecution, others it's going to be because of age or sickness or other things that happen. And so how do you keep the story going? How do you preserve the story? And as God had done in moving men in the Old Testament to write down what He was doing and had revealed to them, so these men were also moved to write. And this allowed the story to continue even after all the original witnesses were gone. But more than that, even while the witnesses were still alive, it allowed them to write down what they knew, and then as copies were made of it by hand, it could be sent to those places who did not yet have the opportunity to hear an apostle or an evangelist or other witness come to them in person and tell them more about Jesus. And this was just as important for those who already were believers as it was for those who had not yet even heard about Jesus, because they needed to know this as well. And that certainly is the case with John as well. When we began this last year about this time, we looked at some of these things that I've reproduced again here in your handout, so I'm just almost mentioning these parts to you. First of all, I have great confidence, as did the early church, that John the Apostle was the author of this gospel. There's all sorts of evidence for that, even though in the gospel itself, it never says John wrote this. It's not like with some of Paul's epistles where Paul says, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to, it doesn't appear in John, nor does it in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And yet there's all sorts of good reasons for believing that John is actually the author of this. And among them is John was in that little inner circle of Jesus' apostles, of Peter, James, and John, who sometimes were involved in things that even the other apostles were not personally present to be a part of. And some of those show up in this gospel. So if it was anyone other than one of those three, Peter, James, or John, then how would they even know that? And yet, the very first of the apostles to die was James, so he's eliminated. And in the Gospel of John, Peter is mentioned a number of times, and we hear things about him, but we never hear anything about John. It's almost like the author says, well, I'm just going to leave myself out of the picture, except to be the journalist, the writer, who produces this and who knows it's true. And so if John is the author, that pretty much limits when the book was written. You know, there are skeptics who have long said, well, John wasn't even written till towards the end of the second century, which would put it about 170 years or so after Jesus lived. But over time, all sorts of evidence has turned up, archaeological and otherwise, that keeps pushing that date back. So even now, the real skeptics are having to say, well, yeah, begrudgingly, I'll admit it must have been written in the first century sometime, probably real late. But that puts it back within the lifetime of John then. But there's even other evidence that might even push it earlier than that. Just today, I discovered another book that was written by a scholar in which he advances very forcefully the idea that the Gospel of John might have been actually the first of the Gospels written, not the last. But be that as it may, we have every reason to believe that John is the author, that it was written while the eyewitnesses were still alive, not only he himself, but others along with him. And more than that, he never identifies who particularly received this gospel first. History tells us, what little bit it does, about the latter part of the life of John, that he spent the last probably 30 to 35 years of his life in and around the city of Ephesus. That's why we see in the book of Revelation, also written by him, I'm confident, he's writing or reproducing letters that Jesus is dictating to the seven churches of Asia. Those are seven congregations in and around Ephesus in Asia. So that seems most likely the first people who would receive copies of this letter or this book, as he himself even calls it. And his purpose in writing it is to provide additional evidence concerning Jesus. For some reason, it bothers the scholars that John records a lot of things that are not found in the other three Gospels, and that the other three Gospels don't mention a number of the things that John does in his. But I think there's a real simple explanation for that. I see in John him saying things that indicates that not only does he know what was already written in the other Gospels, at least one of them, whether it was only Mark or Matthew or whatever, but he knows that his audience also is already familiar with those Gospels. So why repeat what they've already heard and what they've already said? But here he is, an eyewitness to Jesus, who knows about some things that Jesus said and Jesus did that didn't get written down in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. So before he dies, why not include that into a permanent record, such as the Gospel of John? I think that's the most reasonable and common sense explanation for that possible. Another thing that's kind of interesting about the book as he writes it is the way he writes it. He writes it quite differently than Matthew, Mark, and Luke do. Essentially, all three of those Gospels write about what Jesus did and said. And they don't have a lot of what you might call doctrine or theology wrapped into it. On the other hand, John purposely states that his purpose in writing this, according to John chapter 20 and verse 30, is these things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you might have life in his name. So John is not just concerned with what Jesus did and said, but he's concerned about who Jesus was. And then he uses what Jesus did and said and what others around Jesus did and said in reaction to him as the evidence to demonstrate who he was. And so that's his is a more complex and in some ways deeper gospel than the others, even though the others also emphasize that Jesus was a Son of God, was God incarnate, come down to earth, but it's John who focuses on that the most. On page 2 of your handout, one of these things that's a hobby of mine, and I don't necessarily mean that just in the sense that the way that somebody might collect coins or old cars or something, but one of the things I always focus on, and have ever since my mentor, before I ever even started preaching, got me to doing, is noticing the words that are used by any of the writers of the Scripture. Because as a general rule, if a certain author keeps using the same words over and over, he's trying to tell you something. That's a point of emphasis for him. And so I include here a few of the words. We had much more back last year when we looked at this. But in the Gospel of John, he uses the word believe 98 times. That's an average of about a little more than 4 per chapter. He uses the words, and I just sort of lump these together, see or look or behold, which we'll talk a little bit more about before the lesson's over tonight. He used see, look, and behold 134 times. Remember last year when we were covering this, we titled the whole thing, Come and See. Because that expression appears 4 times in the gospel. But there's all sorts of other places and times in which the words see or look or even behold appear. Clearly, John, in recording that, is not just recording what happened or what was said then, but he's saying to those of us who are now reading him, I want you to see. I want you to look. I want you to behold what these people were also seeing. He uses the word know 141 times. In a culture like ours today, where everybody has their own truth, as it's called, and the whole idea that truth is not absolute, John stands against that idea. He said there are things we can know, not just believe, even though he talks about that too, as we just pointed out. But he uses that term know 141 times, as near as I could count, using my computer. And then the words true or truth 48 times. But he wants us also to realize that this is something that, in a sense, has legal standing, because he will use one or the other of the two words to witness or to testify some 47 times in the book. The same kind of expression we would use talking about something happening in a court. We've got a witness. We've got testimony. We've got someone testifying. 47 times in the book. And then something else we'll be looking at tonight, he uses the words glory and glorify 40 times. And I just mentioned those because hopefully this week you'll start reading through the Gospel of John. If nothing else, just reading the first 11 chapters to catch you back up to where we will be starting next week. And hopefully you'll start seeing those words stand out to you, because they're there scattered through every page of his book. And then John has this prologue, this first 18 verses at the beginning of his gospel that nothing like that is in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. They just jump right in and start. But John does something that only an accomplished writer would probably do, and even today, in that he creates a kind of introduction or preface to the book. I'm a book lover. I buy books almost every week. I'm buying books, and they're being added to my library. If I would read them all, I'd be smart. But I'd at least buy them and have them there just in case. But before I buy a book, other than looking at the title and the author, One of the first things I do when I open that book up is to read the preface or the introduction. Because that's where the author is going to tell the reader what he's going to be talking about in the book and where he's going to end up. Now, if you love to read fiction, you don't want an author to do that because that takes all the mystery out of it, doesn't it? It's not a secret until the last page when they finally solve the crime or whatever. But in nonfiction, that's a very valuable thing to have. And that's what John has. He has this prologue in which he paints the overall picture that he's then, as he tells a story of Jesus after that, all the way to the end, it all fits within this bigger picture he's describing in these first 18 verses. And that's the prologue. And so we will cover all this on page 3 about how the book is broken down just as we move through it. But now I want for the rest of our time this evening to look at something he has there in the prologue. Because in the Gospel of John, there are 3 verses that are among the most outstanding verses in the entire Bible. One of them is the very first verse of John, where John says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." That's about as profound a thing as anyone could ever say. Another verse in John that for the last 2,000 years people have considered a very important verse in there is chapter 3 and verse 16. "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him shall not perish but have everlasting life." But here's the third one, chapter 1, verse 14. You see, as John in his prologue is painting this little picture in 18 verses of what the rest of the book is going to do in a lot more detail, he starts out with verse 1 of chapter 1 saying that the Word has been with God even at the beginning. Now, he doesn't start out by telling us who or what the Word is. He just says, as a good writer should do, you don't show everything right up front, even in the prologue. So he starts out by saying, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Every Jewish person, and there's a lot of Jewish stuff in the Gospel of John, because I think part of his audience would be Jewish people, and John definitely was Jewish himself. Every Jewish person would immediately, hearing just that one verse, would immediately think of Genesis and how it began. "In the beginning, God." And that's what John is saying, "In the beginning, God." But he's saying it a little differently, isn't he? Where it says it back there, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and the Spirit of God moved over the face of the deep, and God said..." It's not in our English Bibles until we get to verse 3, where suddenly we hear the Word of God. But John brings the Word back up into the very first verse. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Even though he hasn't yet said what the Word is, but then as he then moves through his prologue here, he says, "Through Him," suddenly he's made the Word an individual instead of a thing. "In Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify," there's our Word, "concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world." He was in the world. That's not John. That's the He that is the Word. "He was in the world, And though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. I try to imagine what it must be, would have been like, and even today, if someone knew nothing about Jesus and had never heard of him, and they're hearing this read or reading it themselves for the very first time. John right away is setting up a kind of a mystery. Here's this word that has been with God since the very creation of the world. In fact, this word is a person, for it's a he, a him, and he participated in the creation. And more than creation, he is the source of life and light. And God sent someone into the world here, a prophet by the name of John, to testify concerning him, to prepare the way for him. And then suddenly, he, the Word, comes. And he comes to his own. Some question about what that own means. Does it mean his own in that since God created mankind, then we're obviously his in that sense, and so he comes to us? Or does it mean more specifically the Jewish people? Because John the Baptist has just been mentioned here as Jewish, and so perhaps that's who he means. But either way, he says he comes to his own, and his own does not recognize him or receive him, accept him. But those that did receive him, he gave the right to become children or sons of God. So far, that's already pretty intriguing for someone who's never heard this before. But then this next verse is the one that really springs a surprise. The Word became a human being. You don't see that coming in the first 13 verses. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Suddenly the reader or the hearer will say, who? Who is it? It was with God from the very beginning and participated in the creation of all things and is a life and light for all men. And it gives people the right to become children of God. Who is it? Who is it? The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We have seen his glory. John, you've seen him? You know who it is? We have seen his glory, the glory as of the one and only Son who came from the Father full of grace and truth. And then he refers back to John again, John the Baptist. John testifies concerning him. He cries out saying, this is he of whom I said, he who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. From the fullness of his grace, we have all received one blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So now we've gone from the Word, who is God, to he, and he who comes into the world, and he who gives people the right to become sons of God, and he has become human flesh, and he is Jesus, John says. So he's going to be talking about Jesus. But let's look some more here at this one verse where it says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. I think we understand the Word, and to some degree at least, because he's already described that in flesh and what that means. But let's look at some more. It says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. You know, God appeared, in a sense, many times in the Old Testament. Sometimes he appeared as an angel, even sometimes identified specifically as the angel of the Lord. But the angel didn't stay around. He came, he did his work, whatever it was, whether it was to speak or to do something, and then he's gone. That happens a number of times. The Lord appeared to Moses in what? A burning bush. And while the bush didn't burn up, while Moses was there with it, there's no indication that after God sent Moses on his way that the bush continued to burn. God was done. He withdrew himself. When Joshua was about to go into the land of promise, they've crossed over the Jordan River. They're looking at Jericho. God is telling them that this is where they're going to begin. And suddenly, while he's there looking at the Jericho and trying to figure out how are we going to take this, suddenly he turns and there's someone else there with him, isn't it? This someone identifies himself as a commander of the Lord's host or army. But then he's gone. When the Israelites come out of Egypt, the presence of the Lord accompanies them in a cloud and a pillar of fire. Pillar of fire by night, a pillar of cloud by day. But it was the presence, in some sense, of the Lord. At a certain point, even after several years, that pillar and cloud disappeared. When God gave instructions to Moses to build a tabernacle, a place where they could come and offer their sacrifices before God, and God said, "My presence will be with you." And so we can read about that. And then when it was finished and it was ready, then it says that the glory of the Lord came down upon it. 400 years or so later, when Solomon builds the temple, the same thing happens again. The glory of the Lord comes down upon it. But now, John tells us, the Word became flesh and dwelt. The word dwelt there, Greek word skenu, means to erect a tent, to build a tabernacle, to set up a dwelling place. So suddenly John is saying, just like God came and lived with his people in the tabernacle and in the temple, now God is coming in human flesh to dwell, to live among us. And it says, and we beheld his glory. Now, depending on your translation, some of them say we saw his glory. In fact, that's what we've entitled this whole series we're doing now. We saw his glory. Others say we have seen his glory. But really, the word see here, if that's what your translation has, is a particular Greek word that means more than just to see with your eye. It means to study it with your eye, to contemplate it, to focus on it, to examine it. And so as the writer says, we beheld, we studied this Word in flesh that was dwelling among us. But did you notice he said, we. John is writing not just of himself, but others as well. Perhaps he's talking about the other apostles. He doesn't identify it directly. Perhaps he's speaking about others who are there with him as he's writing this. But this is the first of three times in John in which the author identifies himself as a witness, as an eyewitness of this one who came to dwell among us. We beheld, we studied his glory. And he's really inviting us now, when we go into the rest of the gospel, to do the same thing, to behold his glory, to study what we're seeing, to contemplate what we're hearing, and see his glory. Because what is glory? That was the expression in the Old Testament for God's presence. And literally, the word, even in the Greek language, means presence. But it means more than just the presence of someone. It means what's significant about their presence. And so all the scholars, when they give their definitions of this word doxa that appears here, his glory, says it's best defined by words such as His radiance, His brightness, His splendor, His magnificence, His majesty, His dignity, His preeminence, His greatness, that which is worthy of worship about this one. If you go back and read any Old Testament, whether it's when the glory of the Lord came down at the tabernacle, or the glory of the Lord came down at the temple, or when the glory of the Lord even settled down on top of Sinai, when Moses and the children of Israel out of Egypt first arrived there, you see His magnificence. You see His glory. And all through the Old Testament, with all kinds of scriptures, it will talk about the heavens declare the glory of God, His magnificence, His greatness. But John says, when we saw this one who had become flesh, who was living among us, we saw His glory. By studying Him, beholding Him, paying attention, we could see it was God on earth. But he says it was the glory of the only begotten Son. The word only begotten in the Greek language is really two words. Monogenēs is a word, but it's really two words pushed together in the Greek. Mono means the one or the only. And genēs means a kind or genus of something. So literally, monogenēs means the only one of his kind. And how true that is. When the Word became flesh, that had never happened before. It will never happen again. He is the only one of His kind. He is the only one of the Father. And He's full of grace and truth. And we're going to see all of that as we continue through the Gospel of John. So look forward next week to joining us when we start in chapter 12 of John. And what we'll be listening for and looking for is to see His glory. Because when we see His glory, then we see that it really is God with us. Emmanuel. Thank you.